And other times he looks so...
This is Wednesday, September the 10th, and Richard and Laura Hill and Phyllis are at the home of Dr. Walter Cooper, going through his papers and bringing some of the papers back to the library and some for Laura Hill's research first. And this is the conversation that proceeds over the looking over and selection of those papers.
Put them sort of next to Dr. Cooper. You can put them there, then you can put the recorder over here.
Okay.
Okay, sir. You're up.
So, you want to know about the February 1963 meeting at Baden Street Settlement Agency?
February 17th.
Well, it was the NAACP and other civic-oriented organizations, such as the Monroe County Nonpartisan Political League, had jointly decided that the time had arrived for a mass meeting on police brutality. Mm-hmm. I and some others had documented 14 cases of police brutality, ranging from the Rufus Farewell, the Faison case, and others. And actively at that time was the A.C. White case. A.C. White most likely had been under the influence of alcohol, but he was brutally assaulted by the police and ended up in the hospital. And a person by the name of Raymond Daniels, who later ran a liquor store on South Plymouth Avenue, had taken pictures, and there are somewhere in someone's file should be pictures of A.C. White. And so we coincided the meeting, scheduled the meeting, under the aegis of the NAACP. I was the chair, and the interim NAACP president at that time was a Reverend Phillips. Mm-hmm. And we knew that Malcolm was going to be in town and most likely would attend the meeting. So after opening remarks and talking about the ravages of police intimidation and harassment and also actual brutality, I looked out into the audience and there was Malcolm X, and so I said, "There, we might have a change of the agenda if it's the interest of the crowd," which at that time was 800. Mm-hmm. The word must have spread around the community that Malcolm X would be there. "We will have a few words by Brother Malcolm." And so Malcolm came up to the podium with big cheers and greetings, and acknowledged the NAACP and the importance of the meeting, and gave us a little background history on what had transpired with the black Muslims while they were at Attica, and what was happening in America. And at that meeting, handbills were passed out saying America had become a police state. Mm-hmm. And I think you have a copy of that. Mm-hmm. Already. And so Malcolm gave a very thrilling talk for about 15 minutes. He not only talked about the irresponsibilities of the Rochester Police Department, but he also talked about the socio-psychology of African Americans. And I remember one of his quotes explicitly. He said, a psychological death would be more merciful than a physical death would be more merciful than the psychological death that many of my brothers and sisters experience today. And he then talked about a little a bit about self-hatred and not having control of your mind and the psychology in terms of your life. And of course he was getting big cheers and everything, and he ended up the talk by stating that I want you to go home in peace. I don't want you to be burning down your own communities, and be men and women, stand up for your children. And that was the end of the meeting. But we had 800 people in the audience. Mm-hmm. Now at that time, the executive director of Bain Street Settlement was Sidney Lindenberg.
Right.
And he admonished one staff member, Ernest Denny, who had arranged the meeting for having Malcolm X on the program. Well, the board of Bain Street did not bring any censure against Ernest Denny, and so that settled down. And then shortly after that, Lindenberg was asked to resign. It was pushed primarily by Loma Allen, I think maybe Jane Goldman, Dr. Knox, and maybe, I don't know whether Nancy Harris was still living at that time. She had, she was an important member of the board at Bain Street, and she had gone on vacation maybe the previous winter or the later winter, and had suffered a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And passed. She was only in her 40s.
Right.
But that was a very interesting meeting, and I think that was the highlight of protest meetings against police actions and brutalities in the early 60s.
I had asked you about this before. Do you recall the correspondence, or were you aware of the correspondence that went back and forth between the National NAACP, so Gloucester Current, who was the head of the mm-hmm. branches, and Flora Harris?
I was vaguely aware of that. I didn't know explicitly that that she was corresponding with. But she, it's kind of interesting. Lots of the vitriol by board members, both in the NAACP and even by individuals in the Urban League, were often directed toward the more aggressive, intelligent members of these boards. Mm-hmm. For example, we had the same thing with the Urban League. We had a meeting in this must have been in 1965 or 66 with Whitney Young, and what came out of the meeting after he was introduced at a breakfast meeting, and this breakfast meeting included the senior vice president of the Eastman Kodak Research Laboratories, John Learmakers. The Whitney Young being told by some people that there was a black power group on the board, and he named Dr. Walter Cooper, Dr. Marcus Alexis, Dr. William Jacob Knox, Dr. William E. Lee, and several other people. And he retreated when Dr. Learmakers got up and said, "That is absurd." And so Whitney Young drew back. But later on, Whitney Young in 1969, I believe, at a National Urban League meeting, really castigated the San Francisco Bay chapter of the Urban League, which had in its membership the psychiatrist and writer Price Cobbs and Robert Brown and Elmore Cooper and others for reading a statement of concern about the Vietnam War. And So he cast the gate at them in a plenary session, and it made them impossible to continue functioning with the San Francisco Bay Urban League, which then went into a deep slide, exponential decay. But people like Whitney Young, even though they had national leadership, they wanted total control over everything and did not leave room for dissent.
It strikes me that that was the case with the NAACP as well.
Well, the NAACP was somewhat like that. I think the NAACP, Gloucester Curran and others, were deeply concerned about the demise, in a sense, of the local NAACP, which had gone from a membership of over 3,000, but with the schism that occurred with the way the president handled the de facto school segregation suit, it drove out of the organization the really foundational leadership in terms of youth activities, in terms of community affairs, in terms of education, and in terms of housing. Dr. Woodward chaired the housing committee. He resigned. Dr. Lee chaired the Community Affairs Committee. He resigned likewise. So it was almost anti-intellectualism, in a sense, to drive really the working components of the organization out of the organization per se. But that was not uncommon. Kenneth Clark, the educational psychologist, was essentially driven off the board of Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited Associated Community Teams after he had written up the huge proposal, which I showed you in the past. And the money came in, then they don't want you around. And that was a similar situation with the FIDE organization, even though the foundation for the formation of it came from what I would call educated class of blacks. And I think it's not so much that these educated blacks wanted to take over the leadership. It was a mere fact that they wanted to observe how the money was spent, and they didn't want that to prevail.
It is clear to me from looking at a combination of two things, some of your papers and then also NAACP papers, that the Rochester branch of the NAACP enjoyed a special relationship with the national branch, mm-hmm. because LaPloy Ashford
had gone to the national as national youth advisor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. There are, there was at least one letter that he had written back to you, sort of funneling information to you about what was happening at the national, mm-hmm. based on the education issue with Quentin Primo, mm-hmm. where again Flora Harris had sent information to the national. It appeared to be sort of behind the backs of the group, and so this strange, confluence of information coming together. And then, as I was saying, in the NAACP papers, there's a rather lengthy letter from Flora Harris in opposition to the meeting at the Baden Street Settlement, and a rather large newspaper clipping file on everything that had ran in the papers about the black Muslims.
But the NAACP had taken an unequivocal stand that although we did not believe in the philosophy of the black Muslim, we certainly had belief in free speech and their ability to articulate their religious beliefs. That came in a newspaper editorial letter by our director of community affairs, or maybe it was under my name. I don't recall now.
Wendell Phillips?
Wendell Phillips was the
president,
yeah.
And it was twisted in the local papers.
Oh yeah, they always do that.
But the national NAACP, after the Baden Street Settlement meeting, sends a letter to all of their local chapters on how to deal with police brutality cases on the black Muslims. Don't invite black Muslims to speak. You can't keep them from coming, but, you know, you need to minimize their appearance. And it's titled, In Response to the Rochester Event.
Well, Flora Harris was unforgiven to me because I was the one who invited Malcolm to speak.
She doesn't name names, only to say that although this was said to be sponsored by the NAACP, it was only certain members of the NAACP, and that they didn't call other members to confirm. That sounded like something you would do.
Yeah. Well, you had to do that these days.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, well, oh, I noticed Brother Malcolm is in the audience.
Right. Right.
I knew he was going to be there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But you go back and look at the dynamics of those days. There were it was very interesting. Like Flora Harris was very actively involved in many NAACP activities, and you know, a strong advocate for NAACP. But I think there were two factors in her life. Her husband was a scientist at Eastman Kodak Company, and in a sense, she was protecting, you know, his position there, because she had known that the Kodak, for example, in 1960, I think I mentioned it to you before, I had gone to bat to defend 900 students whom a school administration had decided to put on half-day sessions out of schools 3, 4, and 19. And I paid a price for that. I didn't get a wage increase that year. And so I'm certain that Flora might have been well aware of that fact.
What was her husband's name?
I think Philip.
Joseph?
Let's see. Joseph Harris was the seed man. What are you reading from?
A letter that says,
I think her husband was Phil. Phil.
Okay.
I think it was Philip Harris, yeah. Because they had a son, Philip, I think, named after the father.
Okay.
My memory is.
This is a great file.
Well, what is that on?
Board of Directors, Baden Street.
Oh, yeah.
They apparently release a statement after A.C. White is hospitalized. Which I didn't realize they were.
Oh, he was hospitalized, yeah.
2 weeks? 3 weeks?
I think over 2 weeks.
Ridiculously long.
They beat him up pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, those were interesting times, and I just. What always amazed me just to do those things, which I think are. In keeping with the respect for humanity, you were castigated for it. See, I have a deep commitment to humanity, per se. And it crosses racial or ethnic lines. I've always been that way, even growing up as a kid in Western Pennsylvania. I often defended kids, black and white, from bullies because I just don't think a person's humanity should be violated, no matter what their background is. But it's not consistent with what lots of people think. What are those?
The Howard University newsletters. Your
That must have been from my
Howard
wife.
Howard University magazine.
Yeah.
You are an amazing collector.
Well, items that I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a presence was the SCLC in Rochester?
Not too significant, because I think people saw the SCLC as probably a competitive entity that would draw public attention away from their own organizations. And let's see, Benny Brass was the minister who had been delegated to operate the SCLC in the Rochester area. And They had a few activities, but nothing of any significance.
There's very little press on them. Once you get past, when the National comes immediately in the wake of the riot, there's very little press on the development of the...
Yeah, even Andrew Young came and didn't get much play.
I intend Andrew Young and...
James Bevel.
Joseph Lowery?
Joseph Lowery didn't come. It was Bevel and Young.
Mm-hmm. And they would walk around in the SCLC uniform of bib overalls and white shirt and try to talk to the kids on the corner who looked at them like they were...
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah, from another planet.
So it was not for them.
Yeah, that was reported in the dissertation that we read, and they would say things like, what is this Jesus stuff?
Expletive.
Like, yeah. They didn't want anything to do with it. And that then, I think the city then turned to Saul Alinsky.
No, the ministers did.
The ministers did.
The ministers did.
Yeah.
It was a move by Reverend Hughes, Reverend Long, Reverend Hill, Reverend, Turnipseed came in later, but those were the primary advocates for the Alinsky organization.
Right.
Yeah. But didn't the SCLC come about because people were worried? I know it came about because of the bus boycott, but wasn't it because people were disenchanted with NAACP, and that's why this new group thing?
Well, I think there was disenchantment with the NAACP, but I think the temper of the community after experiencing lots of police brutality was not... so attracted to something like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I just don't think the temper of the community at that time was that what could they add to what has already been done? I mean, what benefits could the community accrue from instituting a program run and operated by the SCLC, and especially people wearing bib overalls, and you had a large concentration of people who were stayovers from the migrant stream that came to this community, and primarily in the 50s. See, the non-white population went in from 1950, from 7,700 up to over 17,000. By 1957 with a special census. And so people, particularly a large number of people, probably rejected the kind of southern appearance of the bib overall.
While you were on the phone earlier, we were talking about the About Time archive, and within the archive they have this significant sub-collection about the migration north, and a lot of materials.
I think the New York SCAD, State Commission Against Discrimination, put out a nice little pamphlet that shows that the growth. It shows that at the end of World War II, there were about 5,000 blacks in Rochester by 1950. I think it was 7,700. By 1957, 17,000. By census of 1960, 24,000. And by special census of 1964, 34,500. That was the baseline, population baseline, for kicking off the anti-poverty program. 34,500 non-whites in the community. And at that time, you were beginning to see a Puerto Rican, primarily, population that is starting to grow in the city. And that's why when we set up ABC, we intentionally attracted and brought in the members of the Puerto Rican community, like Juan Padilla and others. And by 1985, they had their first candidate for the school board, Nancy Padilla. I kicked off her campaign. She had been one of our In 1965, she had been hired by the Urban League as one of our staff people with the admonition that she go to college at night or even during the summers. One of the nice things about the early days of the Urban League, when we would not hire, particularly under Ashford, we would not hire a inner city person unless they agreed to improve their education. That was a stipulation for the job. But I think since those days, no such stipulations have been handed out or at least suggested to new hirees in some of our social service organizations. What looks interesting, Laura?
You just say look on my face?
Yeah.
I was trying to recall how I'd heard the name Lloyd Hurst. You declined to attend their Get Acquainted meeting due to your moral conscience. The State Commission for Human Rights.
Yeah, because it was malfunctioning. It was a political ploy, Republican political ploy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I took a stand, huh? Well, that's rare, huh?
Earlier you mentioned someone trying to link or associate you with several others to being the Black Power.
That was Whitney Young did that.
And did that disturb you?
No, it didn't disturb me. You know, I've been called everything. It's interesting. I've been called Black Nationalist, Communist, Socialist, Pan-Africanist, Oreo, Uncle Tom. So I covered the waterfront. I'm the universal man.
You know, I was reading in your collection yesterday, it's this outrageous letter to the editor, August of 1961, it was a full year before the Farewell case.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you were involved with this. The members of the NAACP picketed outside of police headquarters, and they were protesting the use of police dogs in black neighborhoods. So there is this sort of reactionary letter to the editor labeling those people that were picketing the junior members of the NAACP. And there was so much packed into that phrasing that, you know, you were obviously newcomers. You didn't know how things in Rochester were done. You know, the NAACP would never, you know, act this way. And so you junior members needed to get in line.
It was a really... There was also a letter, maybe you didn't see it, by a fellow by the name of Stewart, and he said, you know, to keep, and he was an African American. He worked for the county, and he wrote a letter that said, well, if they have to use lions and tigers to keep people in place, then they ought to use them. Then I wrote a letter castigating him, and he tried to sue me.
I did see that.
For defamation of character. I mean, a guy who's going to turn loose lines or tigers on children.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's really sensitive to my saying, well, you know, that's not right, morally compulsive, and so forth.
You spoke a little bit earlier about Ernest Denny.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that he, at different points in his career in Rochester, was a lightning rod. Tell me about him.
He fell under my influence. Ernest Denny had gone to Virginia Union University in Richmond, Virginia, the school of the former Randall Robinson. I think they had coincided at Virginia Union. And he really didn't like his education there because he said when he was there, the board of trustees, 36 strong, 35 ministers. And he was a divinity student at Colgate Rochester Divinity School.
Right.
But he was dedicated not so much to a kind of a revolutionary gospel, but I think I would have classified him more in the terms of a Reinhold Niebuhr type, an advocate of the social emphasis of the gospel. And so naturally gravitated to me, like lots of the younger guys. So we worked together on community issues, and he was very vigorous at Bay Street. He was chastised for that February meeting of Malcolm on police brutality at the Bay Street.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that I was reading about him yesterday was the Rochester Police Department's reports on the riot. And they actually point to Ernest Denny as facilitating youthful unrest, that the police department had tried to meet with him to, you know, talk to him about these, you know, alleged police brutality cases, and he essentially said, "I have no faith in the police department. This is what I see. This is what happens. You can't come in here and tell me it doesn't happen." And so in this report, they were suggesting that the police department had been in touch with his supervisors. They were aware of the situation.
Tried to get him fired.
And they were trying to get him out.
Yeah, try to get him fired.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was educated, a very sane person, and he later left here and went to Wisconsin. I think not Racine, but some other fairly large city in Wisconsin, to run a settlement agency.
Okay.
And he became under the not the influence, but worked with Father, what was it, Drapo, or in Wisconsin, who was a rather radical priest, and he worked with him in Wisconsin, and then he came back to this state as head of the Booker T. Washington settlement agency in Erie, Pennsylvania. But he smoked, and he later died of lung cancer. But he was a close friend. I liked him.
He certainly didn't pull any punches with the police department.
Oh, no, he was frank out front. And but you were, to tell the truth, somehow, as Loma Allen will tell you, somehow violated the preconceived idea of what the situation was by people in this community,
mm-hmm.
including the Kodak executives. No one could tell them anything. What is that?
Self-doubt and black pride. Rochester, New York was the scene of a bitter racial clash 3 years ago. Another clash is brewing. Eastman Kodak and the Negro community are at loggerheads.
Is that out of the Reporter?
America.
America, oh yeah.
April of 1967. It's not what I've seen.
I'm Shroff, who's still alive.
Report, you were suggesting on the migrants. Who were you saying did the report?
The one on, the State Commission Against Discrimination.
SCAD did it.
Yeah, SCAD, yeah.
Okay, there's a copy of it in your papers.
Yeah.
It's there. I've seen it. You guys have it now.
Yeah, it's a little pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
White with blue lettering. Right?
Something not quite right about you.
No, it was interesting times, and what I liked about the early 60s is you had a broad spectrum of concerned blacks. You had the Dr. Knox as the senior member, and then a generation below you had myself, Ken Woodward, Bill,
mm-hmm.
Bill Lee, Marcus Alexis, and then you had the younger group, LaPloy Ashford, Glenn Clater, Ernest Denny, Eugene Newport, Hannah Storrs, and that filtered on down, and you had at that time, before Primo went into his shenanigans, you had a very active youth council, which generated people like Lamar Jackson and others. Lamar's a lawyer now in town, and Jasmer Huffman and Sam Berry, and just a, so there was a continuation. It was like a chain, and nothing like that exists now in terms of leadership. I think you have, you know, the the service institution people up there, and there's really nothing in between. And it's my thesis, if you don't have an active group of educated young people between the ages of 20 and 30, you aren't going to revolutionize anything, especially the life of a community. That's a missing element. What's your smile on your face now?
To the board of directors, from Dr. Marcus Alexis, subject, Minister Florence. Good stuff.
You haven't talked to Marcus as yet, have you?
I have not.
Yeah.
I have
Big
not.
Big red. Marcus is crazy.
I want to try to solidify my plans for going to California before I touch base with him. This is the Uncle Tom, where Franklin Florence identifies you guys as Uncle Toms. It's
I have the newspaper clipping somewhere in the file.
Let's get
this over here. I didn't realize that I had kept that, but
oh, you've got great stuff. Sometimes when I'm going through it, I wonder, does he know this is in here?
Well, it brings it back, the memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Saul Rubin was who? Oh, see, he's from New York City. Commenting on the Rochester.
Well, we had some good people. Janet Reinitz and her husband, Richard. All of them were active in CORE. We had lots of young university people and also professors from the University of Rochester mm-hmm. who were involved. But no such thing is there now, I don't believe. And we had, you know, they used to run the Sidney Hillman lectures at the University of Rochester. And you had Alice Grant, who was actively involved in union activities, and Dr. McKelvey from Cornell's School of Labor and something else. Yeah. But, you know, those were interesting times, dynamic times, and I guess the level of activity, I guess, kept your excitation energy going all the time. Yeah.
I think so.
Is that the Urban League again? Oh, that's the adjuster. You folks continue enough. I'll have to get this in insurance. Hello, hello.
I don't
know.
Dr.
Horton's
garage.
This
is exactly what I'm talking about.
Silentism.
Dr. Walter Cooper, Education Committee.
You can just
press
record.
And
it's worth looking at.
They're talking about their lives in Rochester.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the drama.
Well, the drama was, you know, after it was set up.
Start with how it gets set up.
I got set up. Well, the riots of July 24th to July 26th caused some of the same people to start taking a look at social conditions and economic conditions within the community. And the and after the riots, of course, Rochester was not alone in terms of urban riots across the country. You know, there was the Newark riot, there was one in Detroit and some other urban communities. And so on August 20th, 1964, this is a little over a month after the riot, there was an executive order by Lyndon Baines Johnson which set up the Office of Economic Opportunity. That, let's see, I think that was Executive Order 12436 or something like that. And so Ken Starrant and the Council of Social Agencies, Starrant, S-T-O-R-A-N-D-T, started looking at social economic conditions within the community, particularly in those census tracts where you had a large a non-white population. And so at that time, Seymour Scheer and Porter Homer were influential in the city government as city managers. And so with Starrant's inventory pointing out really the somewhat debilitating position of a large number of the non-white population, they decided that they would immediately try to implement the stipulations of Office of Economic Opportunity. So in early November, they made, Seymour Scheer, I believe, made an appeal to John Learmakers, the director of the research laboratories, to have me go on leave to help set up the anti-poverty program in Rochester, New York. The at the same time, the city manager also made an appeal to the Rochester School District and the Catholic Diocese for personnel, administrative personnel, to get the program into motion. So Sister Jamesetta from the Catholic Diocese, Herbert Greenberg from the City School District, and Dr. Walter Lifton from the City School District, we were the primarily four individuals that were given the charge to getting the program off the ground. So we started writing proposals. One of the first ones written was a planning grant that would give you enough money to really plan for developing proposals out of programs which the community place a high priority on. And as we started writing programs, I wrote the first planning grant, and the money came in, and then we got a fellow by the name of Mr. Lisk as the business manager, L-I-S-K, and then we decided that we needed a citizens advisory panel. Catherine Terrell was on that. I think Juan Padilla and some other people. And somewhere in the files, you'll see a complete list of the citizens advisory panel. So we got hard to work. We really became involved in trying to get programs funded. Critical was the program developed for the youth called Neighborhood Youth Corps. Neighborhood Youth Corps, yeah, NYC. And then there was education. There was a heavy emphasis on education. There was the Light at Schoolhouse tutorial program written primarily by Sister Jamesetta. Then there were three preschool programs. I wrote up the Head Start program. Herb Greenberg and Walter Lifton combined to write up the Work Educational Training Center and the Family Children's Center. These were all three preschool programs. And in each proposal, it was written that the there would be longitudinal studies on the youngsters who were enrolled in the program. There would be a six-year longitudinal study to see which preschool program best prepared the youngsters for the educational experience in the primary grades. The other proposal I wrote up was there was the National Youth Corps, the Job Corps, I'm sorry, the Job Corps, mm-hmm. which later on I was asked by Sergeant Shriver to become associate director of, but I wouldn't leave the research lab. The we had that, and then another proposal, which was never funded, was called Small Business Development Center, and it was a proposal for $91,000. And what it was designed to do, Dr. Marcus Alexis was on leave at Berkeley on a sabbatical from the University of Rochester. He was the first black tenured professor at the University of Rochester in 1963. He was an economist, and he had done rather extensive studies on the marketing principles of within black communities. And so it was designed, really, once it was funded, that when Dr. Alexis returned, he would head up the Small Business Development Center. Well, the when the let's see, by the time of June came around, we had to find a permanent director, because Lifton and Greenberg were going back to the school district. I was going back to the research labs. And so we hired from Neighborhood Youth Corps, we hired, was it David Anderson or Jim McCullough? And then we had a, either one of those was head of the Job Corps. And then we, the permanent director, there had been a recommendation for a person from the National Urban League by the name of Otis Finley. Mm-hmm. And Otis Finley came in around the latter part of June, and I kind of transitioned him and told him that all he had to do with the Small Business Development Center, I had undergone the negotiations for funding. All he had to do was get the board to sign on, send it to Washington, and the funding would come. He never did that. Finley came in, and of course, those days, the OEO had a kind of a strict policy of maximum feasible participation of the poor, per se, on the board. Well, there was always, by the time Finley came in, there was beginning, you had the fight organization formed in June, formalized in June of 1965. And so there was the contention immediately that there was not enough poor people on the board and we should be represented. So Finley fought that for approximately a year, and then he left, and we named James McCullough was named as executive director after Otis Finley. And so the contentions continued. Five members would go to ABC boards and break up meetings, you know, raucous behavior and so forth. And so they couldn't conduct the business at hand. The and it was unfortunate, because the ABC should have been in a position to handle the funds from the joint training apprenticeship program, which was job training, but instead it went to Rochester Jobs Incorporated, headed by Ed Croft, and then Connie Mitchell became essentially his deputy. Now the other thing where they missed out on was the Small Business Development Center, which I had written up and would have been funded, but it was never submitted. It could have been logically designed to promote business opportunities for minorities, both the blacks and Puerto Ricans. But what happened to 1967, the corporate community then formed Rochester Business Opportunity Corporation. But that was the persistent pattern, because in 1960, out of Bain Street, with Dr. Knox leading the charge, we had a TST programs, Tomorrow Scientists and Technicians, which was designed to motivate and increase the interest of particularly more minority students into seeking careers in math and science and technology. This was to take place generally at the middle school level. We received no corporate support. It was a well-designed program run out of the National Urban League, and the national advisor for the program was Glenn T. Seaborg, who had been a Nobelist in physics from the Lawrence Lattimore Laboratories in Berkeley, California. So TST did not fly, did not get any corporate support, and 17 years later they formed the PRISM program in Rochester to inspire students into science and mathematics. But that was the persistent pattern. We would initiate something, get no support, then later on the corporate business would come and do it their own way. And their own way was not to be a competent way. That was just my contention. It just bought the status quo.
Flight eventually gets 3 seats on the
ABC board. Yeah.
Tell me how that comes about.
Well, I was not on the board then. I had kind of pulled back. I just said I would not be part of the community squabbles. I just didn't want any part of that. And so they fight continued to, you know, interrupt, essentially break up the meetings of the ABC board, so that you couldn't conduct deliberations. And finally, McCullough was executive director at that time, and so they acceded to having 3 members of the fight organization on their board.
I am reading a dissertation on Friends of Fight, and one of the things that Friends of Fight wanted to do was to put pressure on the anti-poverty program, and Fight actually would not allow them to do this because they were trying to negotiate for those 3 seats, and then once they had them, they were trying to get funding, some of the anti-poverty funds for a program they wanted to run. And so this was a big issue for Friends of Fight.
Well, what angered me about Friends of Fight, they never lifted one finger for efforts we made through the NAACP or mm-hmm. the Urban League.
Right.
It was as if the liberal white community was also antagonistic toward us, which it was.
A good portion of this dissertation is devoted to emphasizing that the way the Friends of Fight was established, they could not move without Fight's permission. I mean, that was part of being allowed to use Fight's name. And so, I mean, there's case after case after case where they rejected offers to collaborate on projects if Fight said no, they didn't do it.
Well, they wanted a veto on everything in the community. Mm-hmm. Much to the chagrin and loss of the community. Mm-hmm. They didn't care.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, about the white liberals in the community being antagonistic towards Fight.
No, antagonistic toward people like myself. People who had been out front a long time. Dr. Knox, Dr. Lee, myself, Ken Woodward, people like that. They were not friendly toward us. I had colleagues at Kodak, Bert Bittner, there was Larry Garfield. They were all members of Friends of Fight.
And you see, why were they antagonistic?
Because they didn't want any other voice but Fight to be heard in the community. They see what you have to understand about organizations like Fight, and you know, and I heard comments like, well, people of power will meet with us now. Well, hell, we were never interested in meeting with people of power. We were interested in effectuating programs which we thought would help people. But that is the sine qua non for organizations like that. And one of their, my biggest indictment of the of that organization and the Friends of Phi, they place no emphasis on education. And you can't be free in any society unless you're knowledgeable. It's impossible. I don't know any society in the world where you can literally have a quality of life and be relatively free and not have an education. And I'll tell you the ramifications of it. Kodak, after the fight, confrontations and so forth, Kodak kicked off a minority assistance program. And what was this program? It was designed to provide technical positions for minority graduates out of the Rochester School District, including African Americans, Hispanics, and others. Okay? Kodak initiated that program in probably 1967 or so. Before that program ended, now the program itself involved hiring the young, the individual, providing the individual with a mentor, and the once the individual's economic situation stabilized, encouraging the individual to go to college at night, Kodak would reimburse the tuition. So it meant really a free education over a period of time, a free college degree.
Terrific program.
Terrific program. I knew some. In fact, I, even though I wasn't designated as a mentor, I mentored one young man by the name of Kenneth Payne. I've been told that before that program was terminated, they had over 300 had entered. To my knowledge, and I got this these data from one of the persons who was in the program, out of the 300 who entered, only two received college degrees, Mary Webb and Kenneth Payne. And why was this? Because these people had been brainwashed to the idea that only jobs and housing counted, because that was the mantra of the fight organization, jobs and housing. Education was not in the equation. And it even got to the
Friends of Fight did not.
They sanctioned everything that Fight did. Yeah.
But did they feel that they had to do that in order to survive?
They had to do that if they wanted to be associated with the Fight organization. Fight, yes.
Which is ultimately why they become Metro Act.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I never hear of them now. Are they still active?
They are actually. Mm-hmm. They are.
No, it's. I think it's a sad situation, but the thing that interests me is that from situations where I found that the leadership of an organization has been primarily a black minister, they operate the same way, almost an absolute rule. And the fight organization was black ministers. Reverend Schenkel, Reverend Lawrence, and the rest of them, backed up by the ministerial community. The NAACP never got the backing to that extent of the ministerial community, even though I must admit, during the civil early 60s, there were three churches that were very open to civil rights meetings. Enon Baptist under Reverend Greer, G-R-I-E-R, Mount Vernon Baptist under Reverend Warfield, and AME Zion Church under Reverend Andrew Gibson. Gibson was one of the few black ministers who went on the march on Washington out of here. On the march on Washington in August of 1963, for the four busloads that went, only two black ministers were present. A Reverend Turner from a storefront church and Reverend Andrew Gibson.
But there was, I mean, in the development of the police review board and those police brutality cases, the Baden Street settlement meeting, it appears that there were a large number of clergy involved, white and black.
Well, yes, there was, but it was led primarily by Reverend Andrew Gibson.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but we did, they did get support on, in terms of the police review board, advisory review board, yes. But that was, it never really got off the ground good because powerful figures in the community opposed it.
Who?
Particularly the CEO of Bausch & Lomb.
Why?
Because he was a close ally of the Police Benevolent Association.
Hmm.
Yes. He was a close ally of the Police Benevolent Association.
Here's an oxymoron. But I don't understand. I can understand Fight's focus on housing and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. But when discussions about education came up, they just turned a deaf ear.
It was never discussed among them. When Gifford essentially replaced Florence, some of that did come up, but he was a cohort of Adam Abansky, the union leader.
The dissertation suggests that desegregation plans were high on Friends of Fight's priority list, but again, that Fight handicapped them. They wanted not necessarily desegregation, but better schools in the so-called ghettos.
But you see the problem there. But you have to understand, in the naivete of many of these community organizers, they think having a homogeneous, large black community is their power base. And they really are not for integration. In the world in which we live now, the business of a homogeneous grouping, that's part of the past.
Yes.
And it should have been a long time ago. And I tell black students, you have to join the world. You have to start actually talking to those students on your campus who are from all over the world. I said, you have to make friendships from all over the world. That's the challenge before you, because it's a global economy now, and you have to make friends from all over the world.
It's not.
And they don't do it.
No, it's not happening at the
U of R. It's not happening at any institution. Because, see, actually, psychologically, lots of blacks adhere to this principle of place. I will only go in a place where I feel comfortable. I will only, because place has been set aside for them, and they don't even understand that. See, I always live by the belief that, hey, any place in the world where my skills and my interests and my money will take me, that's the place for me. I was criticized because in 1968, I moved out into Henrietta. Moved his wife way out there, separated from the community. And that was the mantra of the bankers in these mortgage loan offices. You want to be away from your people? No, I want to be where my children have a relatively good school district and I'm getting value per dollar spent for shelter. And so, but you see, if your leadership comes from the black church, in a sense, there's a built-in resistance to blacks going to an integrated church because I'm losing my parishioners. There's a woman, I won't call her name, who's an administrator at RIT now. She was told specifically, the Pentecostal church she went to, that, you're not supposed to, this minister didn't want them to read or anything because if you become educated, you stray away from God. You become anti-religion. And it took her many years to break that cycle. That's LaFloy Ashford.
Yeah. Yeah.
When Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety?
School budget crisis.
Well, he was on the school board too,
president,
yeah.
At that point?
Yeah.
Here you go. Integration plan would reorganize city schools.
That's kind of interesting. You know, when the state NAACP filed the de facto school segregation brief in the Third Federal District Court under Judge Burke, that was in May of 1962. That's the day the school district announced its first black principal, Alice Young. And they asked her about, you know, segregation in the schools, and she said, "We educators don't think about that." So she becomes the darling of Monroe Community College, and well, that's what I expect. The problem, as I view it, is that we've never had a true dialogue on race. Neither blacks nor whites want to really talk about it. Very few. That's why when Clinton became president and he had the well-respected John Hope Franklin to head a commission on race to go around the country to talk, it was a complete failure. Complete failure.
How could people not turn out to hear John Hope Franklin?
Well, because they don't want to talk about race. And even in the present political campaign for president, it's the same thing. You know, they won't talk about race to their people who take surveys, voter surveys, but then they'll vote race once they get in the privacy of their booth, voting booth.
I have just been absolutely disgusted by these white women rallying behind Sarah Palin. It has just disgusted me. Absolutely.
Well, they don't have to vote race now. They can vote gender.
Right. That's right.
Well, what about these Hillary supporters that refuse to vote for Obama because not Hillary?
They're the Sarah Palin supporters. Crazy.
They dropped from 27% to 21%, still are threatening to vote for McCain.
Yeah. They were showing the
shift. Well, that's nice.
The shift. I mean, this is where this is coming from. CNN had the shift. And poll numbers of white women since McCain added Palin to his ticket. I mean, it's just disturbing.
Well, I always say we failed to educate people properly.
You can say that again.
Yeah, we failed to educate people properly, to think.
Well, it's frankly enough to make you wonder about democracy, the viability of democracy.
Well, It's not. It's the people who live under a democratic system. We don't have any. You know, I'm all for. I've always said that in the middle schools, students should take a course on logic. We don't have anything like that in the primary grade. They should be introduced to the scientific method. And the middle school years, they should be taught a course on logic. But we don't do that. And it's very difficult to change, to turn around our public educational system. So, have you found any gems, Laura?
There's a ton of stuff here that's great.
So you can study two or three doctorates, huh?
Could you guess? Mean increase.
You want me to move those out of your way, Phyllis?
Income, so I can hire research assistants.
Let me go. I'll go.
Well, that guy must be riding up that deer.
It's over here.
Yeah. Well, it's still recording away. That's a good sign.
The light is still on.
Here, I'm just going to set it here if you plug it back in.
Here, I'll take that one too.
Thank you.
I do.
Well, it's you know, even when serving on the Board of Regents, it's very difficult to get school districts and the teaching profession to change. You know, like our students go to school about 176 days out of the year, and in Europe it's 215, in India it's 220, and in Japan 240, and China 270. You know, and I think learning, there is a relationship between seat time and learning. I mean, there's no way in the world that our students going to school 176 days in the aggregate are going to be as competent, particularly as students in Europe with 215 days. Lester Thoreau, the economist who used to run the Sloan School at MIT, he said, what saves us now is the quality of our higher education system, K-12. It's kids are literally in a sandbox.
It's absolutely appalling to me sometimes to see the level of writing of these students who are admitted to Binghamton University. I mean, you have to grade these papers and drive in every day and see the, you know, one of the top 50 premier public institutions in the Northeast. And I just think, if this is a premier institution, we're in trouble. I mean, some of these students can't put a sentence together. They don't know the prepositional phrases. They can't identify the verb in a sentence.
Or an adverb. Don't talk about that.
They did away, the Board of Regents did away with junior high grammar that I had to take when I was in school. They don't do it anymore. It's terrible. Just terrible.
Well, it even goes further than that. While a regent, we had in New York State, had $10 million grant from National Science Foundation to run a statewide systemic initiative, National Science Foundation program. And it was designed to take 11 schools in pre-K to 8 in New York State and revolutionized the teaching of math and science. Well, Rochester had 3 schools that of the 11, and so I was I was principal investigator for the 3 schools in Rochester and the 1 in Buffalo, and so there were 7 others, and a disproportionate number didn't. I think New York City only had 3, and then they were dispersed 1, 2 or so among Yonkers, Syracuse, and so we used to have staff development programs at RPI. We'd bring them in for the summer, a 2-week program, and the money paid for the staff to be there. Almost invariably, we would have only about a 30% participation from the staff in Rochester. And so when the question was asked, why didn't you attend the staff development program? We brought in experts in, you know, in terms of teaching math and science. And the response would be, well, I became a teacher because I wanted summers off. So, well, why did you agree to participate in the program? And they shrugged their shoulders. At midpoint, it was a 5-year project. At midpoint, one school left voluntarily out of the 3 in Rochester. Another one was asked to leave. We started originally with schools 39, 43, and 55. 43 left voluntarily. 55 was asked to leave. And the most expert teacher at school 39 really became a great teacher. She was the New York State Teacher of the Year in 1999 and the National Teacher of the Year in 2005. And so I maintained for a long period of time contact with her, and she said that I said, well, did the district ever attempt to diffuse your methodologies throughout the schools, particularly the middle schools? No, what she told me, they ignore me. And you know, you try to promote excellence and you run up against resistance. In 1992, I believe, or 93, the regents in our legislative proposal was able to get the legislature to agree to funding of what we call an EIT program, Excellence in Teaching. And that program was designed for a district to have monies to really provide bonuses for their teachers of excellence. Well, it went along okay for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden the union said, well, all of our teachers are excellent. So that went about a couple of years, and then the legislature got smart and said, well, you know, we aren't going to promote a program that involves, you know, sending a bag of money to a district and they divided it up among their teachers. So it's very difficult, but the community's in for, the state is in for a tough time.
Brizard is talking a bit about increasing the hours, isn't he?
Oh yes, he knows. I would increase the hours just if you could let the kids run around during physical education, because they don't do that anymore.
That's right.
You turn the clock back 15 years or so, and you look at the all-county football squads and basketball squads, you know, they were generally 70-75% from the inner city. Not anymore. Franklin used to be a premier school in terms of basketball, football, and track and field. Not anymore. When I was working with Janie over there in 1999, the football coach in the spring did a survey of the incoming freshmen and the upperclassmen. And he wanted to know how many had an interest in football. 64 expressed an interest. He sent out for preseason drills something like 92 or 94 letters, and how many kids showed up for the first day of practice? 22. The following winter, the girls' JV basketball team, in February, a couple of the girls caught the flu. They only had a membership of 7, and they had to cancel the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. And then spring, first day of track and field for the girls, only 3 showed up, so they didn't have a track and field team. What puzzles me is, you know, it's a serious situation, but people don't think it's serious. Both not only in learning, but also in the physical well-being of kids. I sat for some time on a steering committee for an ambulatory diabetic unit over on the old Genesee Hospital campus. And the data show that close to 10% of the population in metropolitan Rochester has diabetes. And endocrinologists say the newborns of today, unless the situation changes rather dramatically, 1/3 of them will have diabetes by the time they reach the adolescent years. But, you know, people walk along and everybody's happy. I don't see it, but that's the reality. But it's an inability to deal with the reality. One time I was interviewed, and an article was written in City East on something like it was a series of articles run by Ron Netsky on a seminal mind or something like that. And I said, well, in the black community, the 3 R's are not reading, writing, arithmetic, but rap and other forms of entertainment, reefers and other forms of drugs, and religion. because those are the three escape mechanisms, escape from reality. You hide in the church, you hide in music, or you hide in drugs.
Bet that went over well.
Yeah, right.
Well,
he's real popular with the churches.
I'm popular with the ministers.
Yeah.
Whenever I see him, I say, you know, Reverend, I'm thinking of starting my own church.
Oh!
Yeah? The first thing I'd have would be a library and a competent person to run it. Incidentally, does your church have a library? We're working on it. No, well, but historically I've had a tough time with the black church. You know, Martin Luther King, you know, well, you know, even during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, the largest black church body did not support Martin Luther King. See, that A.J. Jackson of the National Baptist Convention said he couldn't support King in the Civil Rights Movement because King was a communist duke. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, he wasn't alone in that thought.
No, he wasn't alone.
And if he wasn't a communist duke, then he was an FBI duke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you reading?
I do not know how you worked a full-time job.
I had high energy level.
And did all of this. A psychotic energy level.
Crazy.
Not eating desserts.
Not eating desserts, that's right.
That's where you made
a I didn't get on a sugar high. Sugar high dissipates energy.
Because they're downs. Drastic downs.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Urban League, Education and Youth Incentives Committee.
I have some letters somewhere where I wrote one for a Chinese American colleague. Did I tell you about that?
Mm-mm.
1976. She was a graduate in physical organic chemistry from Purdue, postdoctored at MIT, had at least five publications before she came to Kodak. In reputable journals, and so they literally had her doing technician's work, and you know, she was very discouraged, and so she came to me and said, well, what can I do? I said, well, you're Chinese American, you speak Mandarin and Cantonese and some other Chinese dialects. The country has, Nixon has opened up diplomatic relationships with the People's Republic of China 6 years ago, so why don't you suggest to the international division that it might be in Kodak's short-term, long-term interest to try to establish a marketing presence in the People's Republic of China? So I essentially drafted the letter. She sent it to Wiley Robeson, the head of our international photographic division, and he never answered. Well, the letter went something like this. I'm Chinese American. I've been with Kodak X number of years. It closes my resume, and I think that it may be opportunistic for Kodak to consider developing a marketing presence in People's Republic of China. And, you know, I'm willing to sit down with you and your colleagues and to discuss this issue, what can be done. He never answered the letter. He Wiley Robeson called up her boss. Her boss called her and chewed her out, and she left the company a year later. That was in 1976. It should be in the file somewhere if I can ever find it. Copy of the letter. Well, there's one talk I gave to international educators in 1991. The global economy. Mm. It should be come up in one of these files. There were 3,000 in attendance. They listened, but people at Kodak didn't listen. Where I worked, somewhat, you know, but I wasn't the only one there. You know, Kodak had a digital camera as early as 1973. In 1982, they had a nice small digital camera on display. Pardon me. On that bridge cafeteria. Over. Yes. Here, I be.
All right. Well, as was suspected.
Don't be an advocate or a devotee of Jesse Jackson. He never really accomplished anything except for Jesse Jackson. So, you know, and I know what he did in Rochester, exactly nothing. He came here and, you know, he was supposed to rescue Madison High School. He did all right. It closed a year and a half after he left. That was probably 69, but probably it was 1979. But they, members on the committee rejected Kenneth Clark, Jerome Kagan, Gerald Zachariasen, competent people. And I think you find the same kind of pattern still persisting in, like, the Children's Zone. They spent close to $1 million and nobody's been helped. See, they could have done better by just taking that money and dividing it up and saying, well, this is going to go into, what is it, a 529 educational savings program for your child when your child wants to go to college. This is a good start. But when things get worse, they don't get better. So, Metro Act, what is it doing today? What is it emphasizing?
They were Metro Act until just recently, and they changed their name again. but they were, they have a website. You can Google them and find this stuff. They did, one of their last big actions was on busing. The city was trying to change the city bus patterns.
Routes, yeah.
And so they were protesting that.
Well, it's sad. Even I don't think they have, well, the fight organization must be no longer in existence.
So. No, it's not.
But the thing about it, Lisa, they talked black and we're for African Americans, yet the only black architect in this town, Thomas Boyd, they never hired. For Fight Village, which later they had to tear down on West Main Street. And I'm certain Tom Boyd could have put together something very nice and reasonably priced. Yeah, I think the Museum Science Center has lots of his work on view. He was an interesting man. Someone should have done it. A biography of him. He graduated.
Is it the Monroe Community Hospital?
Yeah. Okay. He graduated from Brown University in 1927. Got a master's in civil engineering from Syracuse. And then in 1931, he came to this, saw an ad in the New York Times, came to this town and interviewed with the Freeman Firestone architectural firm. And was accepted as a member of their staff. And that was essentially unheard of in the late 20s, early 30s for a Ivy League trained African-American professional to be able to get a job in corporate America. So he was unique, and kids don't know about him. People don't know about him. Bill Johnson names a street after a preacher, not after Tom Boyd or anybody like that. See, that's part of the anti-intellectualism in the community.
What materials does the Rochester Museum and Science Center have of his?
Well, I think lots of his drawings and maybe his educational background. He has a daughter that's still interested in preserving his name. I think I can give you her telephone number. Her name is, please do, Dolores Boyd.
This is great.
This is really good.
Wonderful. I have read interviews he's done where he has read a lot, addresses, children, you know, children's birth dates, their married names, you know, their phone numbers. I mean, just amazing.
So, would you rather not there be a press release about you?
Oh, they can do it. I was just...
What about a press release about your papers being at the university?
That's okay, too. Let's see. Dolores Boyd. This is her business address. I don't have her home address. It's... You have a pencil?
Yes, I do.
Six... 97 mm-hmm. 01 oh, what is this? Can't even read my own. 0103? Let me check that. 0103, yes. Okay. Dolores Boyd, B-O-Y-D-E. 697-0103.
There's her father's Tom.
Thomas Boyd, the architect. Brown, he was born, and Brown, he was educated. That's what he used to say. That's what he used to say. He was a good friend of mine. Yeah.
I just came across a file that was labeled Letters Recent.
What does it say? About 40 years ago?
1979.
Maybe you'll find... No, you won't find the time. I have some more letters and stuff I have to pull out. I was part of an agricultural teams group that had two PhDs in agricultural technology. We were operating 1974, and we were focusing on black farmers. We ran a program from farm to market, bringing fresh produce to inner city housing projects and stuff from rural areas in Georgia and North Carolina and so forth. We had a Manda Sosa was from Zimbabwe. He was on our staff. He was a PhD from Cornell, and there was a Jamaican who also had a PhD. I have some files on that somewhere, but what really angered me is I went to a NAACP working weekend at Morgan State University. This must have been around 19... It was in Baltimore, 1974 or 75. And I brought up the issue of economic opportunities for the high concentration of black farmers that are located in the border between Virginia and North Carolina, at around the place where Floyd McKissick had established a community. And I brought it up as an issue, and I said it would appear to me there may be a congressional black caucus initiative to actually encourage the participation of these black farmers in food exports all over the world, you know, because the United States was the world's largest producer of foodstuff. And so the moderator of the program said, well, that's interesting. Next agenda item, just passed it over. So that was, I would never waste the weekend going and talking to those folks again.
Did you find that recording?
I think I can put my hands on it. Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
There's some great local stuff here. The Catholic Interracial Council text of a sermon delivered by the Reverend Daniel Berrigan at the First Annual Communion Breakfast.
Yeah.
Council of Rochester. I mean, the whole text of his
There's others here, but the Berrigan one is nice.
I love that
recording of that.
Reverend Benedict Amen, Catholic Interracial Council of Rochester. It's just fantastic material. Evaluating the effectiveness of the social council, social agencies, that I've seen, you know, five copies of it in five different folders. Mm-hmm. So there's two of them here. Mm-hmm.
The name of the person who contacted you about comments for the press release?
Hagen, I believe. I can get the...
That's okay.
You don't need to go to a gym. We've got you running today.
Oh, no, no. My weight is what I... I'm probably 2 or 3 pounds lighter than I was when I played college football.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I played 3 years and five plays. I tore my knee out at Granville, Ohio, Denison University, fifth play. I was playing cornerback, and the little halfback came around the end, and I went up to tackle, and he's veered that way, and I went to turn, and the cleats wouldn't give out of the turf, and the knee just went pop, anterior cruciate ligament. Vos is dos. What is that, Laura? What is that?
I thought you were asking me what you were saying. And you said it to me 6 times before, so I should remember. It's the Frederick Douglass voice, but it's, I was trying to determine what, if these are letters to the editor.
He was kind of critical of us, too.
The saga of...
It was the old, that's Howard Coles.
The saga of Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller and...
He was a strong Republican, and so that...
But Jackie Robinson was...
Jackie Robinson, too, and I knew Jackie.
He was in Rochester for something.
Coles was a strong Republican?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because his brother worked for the county. He was clerk at the
but not Nixon Republican.
Robinson wasn't Nixon Republican because I led the first group to picket Nixon at the West End White House gate with Jackie Robinson, Floyd McKissick. That was in the Washington Post. I was on leave from Kodak and I caught hell for that. But I tried to keep it under control. You know, I want it to be really a kind of high level, civilized march. And that's what it turned out to be. And I had Stories Artman, who was in Washington at that time working in the executive offices of the White House, he came to my defense, but that didn't make any difference to the Kodak people. But I was a tool of Kodak, according to the five people. That's always made me laugh. That shows you how little real information they had.
J. Edgar must have had a file on you.
Oh, he does, J. Edgar Hoover.
Have you requested it?
No, I haven't requested it.
You should.
I should, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think only you can do it.
Yeah.
Until you're dead, you're the only one.
Freedom of Information Act. Right. I'll do it eventually one of these days.
Oh, it'd be wonderful to see what it is.
I know what it is. Hanging around with Malcolm X and,
you know,
Jackie Robinson.
Well, and
I'm going to fill out the paperwork for you and bring it, so you just have to sign it next time I'm here.
And hanging around with, Dick Gregory, the comedian. One time, I don't know whether I mentioned it to you, Dick Gregory gave a presentation over at RIT, and I went out and heard him and greeted him warmly afterwards, and we talked for a while. Next thing I knew, I came home. I was followed all the way from Henrietta.
Oh my God.
And I got to Clark Road, and instead of coming home, I went down into Panorama Plaza, swung around the back end of that, and then that's when they lost me, and I came on home. Yeah.
Yep, Jager is still, he does have a file on you.
Oh, yeah, Jay does. And I'll tell you something else. In the latter part of the 60s, I was audited strongly by the IRS, and not only the feds, but the state.
Oh my God.
But we, you know, we played tricks on them too, like sales tax. Bill Lee, and he said, "Well, if you get audited, I have you take all of my receipts and pile them up with yours. And if I get audited,
they